Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, a very special interview with former State Poet Laureate Daryl Bourk, who received the Louisiana Writer Award at the Louisiana Book Festival this year. And Ted O'Brien talks about his year as an author escort. Daryl Bourk has looked long and hard at his native Louisiana and made a world for readers. He has been our explorer, our cartographer, and our troubadour. Inspired by family, culture, landscape, music, and art, and love, always love, he has written poems for the ages. For many Louisiana writers, he has been teacher and encourager, and an example of how to live a writer's life with generosity and grace. He has been the Louisiana Poet Laureate from 2007 to 2008 and 2009 to 2011, and he recently received the 2014 Louisiana Writer Award at the Louisiana Book Festival. Daryl, I'm so happy to be with you.
It's good to be with you, Susan.
What is the spiritual practice that informs your writing the most?
Oh, that's a really interesting question, and you're the first person to ask that. It's sort of a spiritual practice that falls outside of anything that has a name or a label. I begin every morning with a kind of meditation, and I call upon, you know, all the spiritual leaders that I've ever appealed to. I was brought up Roman Catholic, and I'm not a practicing Catholic now. I have received my first refuge vows in Buddhism, and that sort of came to a standstill at that particular point. Mm-hmm. And when we were getting ready to take the refuge vows, you know, sort of like a good Catholic, I asked my teacher, what were the repercussions if one fell back at that particular point? And he said, you know, when you take the first refuge vows, there's almost no repercussion if you just resume, you know, a life that's not led by Buddhist principles. But if you take the second vow, that's really serious. And so for right now, I'm just resting there with the first vow.
Impressive. Now, in 2010, you published In Ordinary Light, New and Selected Poems. And it's so interesting to me when a poet chooses to do that, chooses to see that the time is right, you know, to go back and evaluate your own work. What was that experience like for you when you were doing it?
It was a really wonderful experience because, first of all, several of the books were out of print. And
right.
So when I was given the offer of doing a new and selected, I had to decide at that particular point which poems I wanted to sort of give an extended life to in that book. And it became really interesting to me because now that that book several years old, sometimes I'm sort of surprised at the poems that made it into the book and surprised at the poems that didn't make it into the book. But it's a real interesting crossroad for a poet to be asked to do a selected edition.
You know, at the end of the year when I worked at the Times-Picayune, I would go back and read everything I'd written that year, and it was always kind of a shock.
Right. It is. You know, because sometimes you're sort of surprised that you said certain things.
Right, exactly. Now, memory has been an important muse for you, not just family memory and personal memory, but cultural memory as well. And in Megan's Guitar, which is such a wonderful book, you examine the great diaspora from many, many perspectives. And it's so closely tied to our history. Talk a little bit about how maybe creating those poems was a bit different for you. It was a different writing project.
It was a different writing process because I allowed myself at that particular juncture in my writing to really rely upon history and to allow the poems to be straightforward, direct, historical poems. And I had never done that before. You know, I had worked in a narrative tradition. I had worked with the lyrical poem and even had done some work with experimentation and, you know, seeing if I could be a respectable postmodernist. But
maybe you don't want to be respectable.
Right. But at that particular time in my life, I became interested in the diaspora and realized that I had never addressed it directly, and, mm-hmm. and it seemed that it was the right time to do that.
These characters in this book are so vivid and real, and their voices, they just keep echoing with the reader long after you turn the last page. And I wonder if you'd read one of my favorites, that early life at Camp Beausoleil.
Sure, I'd be happy to.
Okay.
One of the things that happened in the writing of that particular book was that it occurred to me that these particular people almost didn't make it into history.
Wow.
The people of a diaspora don't make it into history. So that was sort of, you know, another impetus to explore that particular history as a possible field for poems. And so this recounts the early life at a place on the Bayou Teche, we think, where that 193 or so Acadians in that migration settled near what we think is Lauraville, Louisiana. And so here's the poem, Early Life at Camp Beausoleil. They did not know the things that could undo them all, and it is that unknowing that surely must have saved them. Fevers would come later, as would snake bite, and a pull robbing them of both strength and numbers. What stemmed the loss was what they saw and felt. Their herds of cattle grew on the savannas and the vacheries. Plenty extended in dark soil they carried with them from their lives in Beaubassin. They knew not one word the Attakapa said to them or to each other, but toil has its own language, and people working together under blue skies that know no geography specific to anything often coil more than grass or clay. New world people learn to listen, to call in different tongues, and they cannot be bothered by the hem of boundaries. New world people have 100 words for fall and how to rise from fall, and they write those words in anthems.
I love that poem so much. I do.
I do.
Every time I hear it, it makes me, oh. Yeah.
You know, those early people in that first large migration of Acadians, as I like to call them, were in a territory that was so foreign to them. And I can't imagine what that life, you know, must have been like. They were wrapped in their wools, and wooden shoes. And here they were in, you know, boggy swampland and
hot
mosquitoes and humidity and heat that they had never experienced before.
And all the things we still live with today.
That's right.
Now, your most recent work, If You Abandon Me, was inspired by the life of Amédée Ardoin. This is a gorgeous little chapbook. It's so beautiful, and it's haunting both for the story behind the poems as well as the poems themselves. I wonder if you'd tell us a little bit about the Amédée Ardoin Project.
The Amédée Ardoin Project is a community project that we started several months ago with the publication of the Amédée Ardoin Songbook, which goes by the title, If You Abandon Me, Comment Je Vais Faire. In that first part of the title, there's not an original Daryl Bourke word. Those are two phrases from Amédée Ardoin's songs mm-hmm. in two different songs that he recorded. But in that project, we joined the Ardoin family, which is still a very important music family in traditional Louisiana music. The older members of the Ardoin family are the children of Alphonse Boissec Ardoin and the relatives and children of Canray Fontenot, two early Lala musicians. So the children of that particular branch of the Ardoin family had for a long time been trying to retrieve the remains of Amédée Ardoin, who died in 1942 at the Louisiana Hospital for the Mentally Disturbed. And what they found when they began to investigate and what they were told was that there were over 2,000 people who had been buried in unmarked graves in a special section of the grounds at the hospital called the Negro Cemetery, and that there was no way of knowing, of being able to retrieve Amadeus' remains. And so they were sort of disheartened by finding that out about Amédée Ardoin, and they began to think in terms of some kind of public commemorative for this musician who's sort of the bedrock of all Cajun and Creole music in Louisiana. And I thought it was time for us to create a community effort to join the family in creating a public commemorative. And so we have a steering committee that's made up of members of the Ardoin family. Patricia Cravens, who is an educator and an actor and an activist, and is my co-director, and we have several other people on the committee. But we felt that it would maybe be even more appropriate, a thing in the realm of social justice, for a community group to get together and create this public commemorative along with the family.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you've been reading these poems and performing with musicians.
Yeah.
That must be a blast for you
to do that. And, you know, I've never performed twice with the same set of musicians, so I'm being introduced to this incredibly rich music resource that we have in Acadiana. In our kickoff fundraiser, I read alongside Dexter Ardoin, Chris Ardoin, Corey Leday, and Mr. Goldman Thibodeau. He's 82 years old, and he's still a performing musician. He's the leader of Goldman Thibodeau and the Lautel Playboys. So he performed there, and then I've performed with other people as well.
See, your troubadour credentials are going way up, as we speak.
And it's really exhilarating.
I can see it.
Yeah.
And in writing this book, you drew from actual historical moments in Amadeus' life.
Yes, yes. And they're moments that are preserved in stories. You know, until this time, hardly ever written down, but stories that are passed on in the oral tradition. What we get are some of his relatives or some of his acquaintances saying, they say.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And this poem is a story about something that they said about him, how he was found hitchhiking from time to time on the roads near Alexandria when he was a patient there.
So now you can read On the Road to Alexandria for us.
When I picked him up, he was walking way too close to the road. He waited a long time before he made a move to come to the car. I asked his name and he didn't answer. I asked where he came from and where he was going. He just looked straight ahead, like he saw some figuration in the distance, but was blind to anything up close. His fingers moved constantly, like he was playing something or another, or trying to remember something in his hands. I asked where home was, and he pointed south. We drove that day from Gina to Pineville, where they took him in. And the recent events in Gina, he was walking into a dangerous territory. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, he had taken the wrong turn. He was going north rather than south.
Oh.
Yeah. And his home was south of Pineville in Eunice. Mm-hmm. But the man picking him up, I imagine, assumed, you know, that he belonged
right on
those grounds in that institution.
Now, in your work as poet laureate, you've traveled all around the state and seen all different kinds of performers and audiences and places, the kinds of places where poetry is performed. So what do you feel is the state of poetry in Louisiana? You think it's alive and well these days?
I think it's incredibly alive. And we have a really, really strong spoken word activity in Louisiana, led by spoken word poets who perform in the New Orleans area, in the Baton Rouge area. Patterson, Louisiana has a big spoken word project, as does Grand Coteau, Louisiana. And so that's one of the things that's really exciting, because for me, when I listen to the spoken word poets, I hear poetry in the way that it was originally transmitted from one person to the other. And there were no texts originally. And that had a great deal to do with how poetry became what it is, and, you know, why there's rhyme in poetry and why there's repetition in poetry. It all made it easier to remember. And so the spoken word tradition is very much alive, but there are incredible poetry centers. You know, when I think of the poets just in the city of New Orleans, you know, the poets who direct activities at Dillard University and at Xavier University and Loyola University and Tulane. I mean, we have Peter Cooley, who's one of the state's great poets, and Roger Kemenetz and Mona Lisa Saloy. And that's just one city. The same thing happens in Natchitoches, you know, where Julie Cain teaches. The same thing happens in Baton Rouge, where our current poet laureate lives and works, Ava Level Hayman. But that's true throughout the state. And it's true, you know, there's a new book of poems that was just published by Gennaro Smith, who teaches at Louisiana Tech. And the title of that book is The Land Baron's Son, The Story of Lilia and His Seven Wives. And that's a really important book of poems.
It's an amazing book, isn't it?
It is an amazing book. And so all over the state, in colleges and universities, there's that kind of activity. And we have these incredible presses that support poetry. Tintamarre Press at Centenary publishes poets only in French. you know, and just this week, I was at a ceremony where we honored Kirby Jambon, who's been called to the French Academy to receive an award, the first Louisianian ever called to the Academy to receive an award from these men and women who call themselves the immortals.
Yeah, that's impressive.
Right.
So given all this, and given the fact that you are performing so much, when for you is the poem finished? Is it after you've written it, or is it when you read it to someone and hear?
It happens at the desk. You finally make a decision, you know, that you've said what you have to say in that particular poem. I'm working right now in a poetic form that I've devised for myself. It's a variant of the Italian sonnet. And when I've written the 14th line,
That's it. Got it.
Yes.
Well, because I can, I want to ask you if you would read one of my favorite poems from An Ordinary Light, and that's Lumina. I love that poem so much.
I'll be happy to. Lumina has a kind of interesting history because when I wrote it, I had been working, I think probably for the past 3 or 4 years, I've been working in that sonnet form that I devised for myself. And sometimes when I hit what something like a writer's block with the sonnet form, I'll try to go to the freer forms that I wrote in up until just a few years ago. And so lots of times those poems are just sort of toss-off poems to see if I can get back. And that's what Lumina was. And then it surprised me because it became something that I didn't know. It said something that I didn't know it would say. Lumina. We're all extensions of someone or another's golden light. In the moment I was made, stars filled the sky, and some parts of the bodies making me were fleetingly illuminated, briefly luminous. Druids see light in wood and worship trees. When we wave in recognition, we disperse light, set light in motion toward the beloved. We string lights on trees in wintertime. We want to see ourselves in the dark.
I love that. We've been talking with Daryl Bourque, who recently received the 2014 Louisiana Writer Award. Daryl, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
It's been my pleasure, Susan. Thank you.
Ted O'Brien does a lot of literary things. He reads a lot, for starters. He's a writer,
He's a bookseller, Garden District Bookshop, and he's a literary escort. I ran into him lately and he said he'd had an interesting year driving writers around, so I thought we might all like to look back and catch up with Ted. Ted, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thanks, Susan. It's good to be back. It's been a couple years now, I think.
I know. So who's been in your passenger seat this year?
My year began with Nancy Horan, and I had her for 2 days. Actually, may have been 3 days. And that's been a continuing theme this year, is that I've had multiple days with who I've had to drive. And Nancy was great. And I also got to do the rare handoff, or the tag team relay for media escorts, where I had to deliver her to someone else in Alabama for her next gig.
Oh, what fun.
It's a lot of fun.
So you had a road trip with Nancy.
I did. And she was not the first road trip. And it was also her birthday. And I believe her husband had sent her flowers, and we'd put them in the back of my car. And we'd driven to Alabama and handed off to the media escort. And I was driving back to New Orleans, and I realized my car smelled really, really good.
Thank you, Nancy.
Yes. And so I called her. I said, Nancy, I'm so sorry. Your husband's flowers are in my car. She goes, well, enjoy them.
Oh, so sweet.
Yeah.
Did you like her book?
I did like it. And the thing is, I had not read her first book, which is Loving Frank, mm-hmm. A book that everybody seems to have read except for me.
And Under the Wide and Starry Sky was just such a great escape novel, I thought. I loved it.
No, she's a really, really great writer. You know, I should probably add here real quick that I rarely ever read anybody's books before I drive them.
Really?
Yes. In fact, I make a point not to do it. So I read her book after I had driven her.
Why do you do that?
Well, my thinking is, when I have a new client, whether I've met that person before or not, if I haven't met them, then the first thing I need to do really is to establish some degree of trust. You know, mm-hmm. they need to know that I know what I'm doing. And the last thing they care about is what I thought of their book.
Really?
Yes. I mean, they want to make sure, first of all, that my car looks good and that I know where I'm going and I know what I'm doing. And once we get to that point, you know, they're going to meet a whole bunch of people on their book tour or their book signing that are going to tell them how much they love their book. And that's good. But the last person they need to hear that from is from their driver, really.
Oh, and I'm charmed by the idea that you always meet them with a bottle of water.
Yes.
That, of course.
That's
attention.
Right. I do that.
Now, you had one whole gang of writers.
I did. This was a first for me. I had...
How did you get them all in your car?
Well, I couldn't. I had to rent a van. This was a
oh,
first.
Wow.
This was a first for me. What we had was, it was called the Dark Days Tour, and it was supposed to be only for YA authors who were doing a four-city tour. Well, it turned out that they were bringing spouses.
Wow.
And adding a local author, Claudia Gray, mm-hmm. who joined for the New Orleans leg of the tour, and Ransom Riggs, who was not officially part of the tour, but he is married to one of the authors. So he was one of the husbands in tow, basically.
Yeah.
And I suspect Ransom Riggs is probably pretty well known, at least probably more well known than some of the other writers that were with the group. But he was sort of staying in the background. Needless to say, this was a very, very crowded van. And to make matters more interesting, it was during Mardi Gras.
Wow.
Yes. So not only did I have to squire around a van full of people, I had to do it around the parade route.
Oh, Ted, that's masterful. And then you had Kim Harrison, too?
I did, yeah. And Kim was interesting because she's also from Ann Arbor, like I am,
Aww.
Ann Arbor, Michigan. And in fact, we knew a lot of the same places. And I think we were probably around the same age, to a degree, maybe the same high schools. Not same high school, but in mm-hmm. high school at the same time.
So what about Alan First?
Alan's great. This is my second trip with Alan First, mm-hmm. and he and I get along pretty well. And he said next time he came to New Orleans for pleasure, he would hire me to drive him around just for fun. But he's really, really fun. I have read his books, mm-hmm. and I really enjoy them.
And he's really devoted. He comes to New Orleans for every book, doesn't he?
He does. And he specifically comes here because he likes New Orleans and he wants to support New Orleans. And I believe, and maybe you interviewed him, he talked mm-hmm. about it, but he really wanted to do something for the city after the storm as well. And he felt that the least he could do as a bestselling author was to come here and do just a book signing, if that was all he could do.
And he has terrific fans. I mean, they really are devoted to his work.
His fans are rabid. And, you know, his books are really, really terrific. They're really atmospheric, and you know, for people who miss his Cold War espionage thrillers, he does a great job of those.
He does. And you had an amazing musician on your list as well this year to drive around.
I did. And one of the things I had to remind myself is that the more famous the person I'm driving, the more likely it is that something may change at the last second. So Peter Yarrow from Peter, Paul and Mary was in town to promote his new book. He and Paul, or Noel Stuckey, had done a sort of a picture book as well as text in it about Peter, Paul, and Mary. And Paul Stuckey was not here, of course, but Peter Yarrow was. But there were some last-minute changes at the very, very beginning, including where he was going to stay and where he was going to appear or whatever, and our signals got crossed. So it was one of those rare occasions where I lost the author prior to finding him.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Yes, I did find him, and everything was fine. But it's not unusual for somebody who's very high-profile to have those last-second changes. There was someone I didn't tell you about who I was supposed to be Marcus Samuelson's driver.
The chef.
Yes, when he was here. And I was called off at the last second on that because he had gotten into town an hour earlier or something and he needed someone right away. And I was on my way and that was it. They called and said.
Sorry.
But that's the nature of the business, I think. And that was a good reminder to me that those things can happen. Those intangibles can happen at the last second. You need to be ready for them.
And now, one of your passengers this year was, I think, an old friend, Rick Bragg.
Yes. Rick Bragg wrote a biography of Jerry Lee Lewis with Jerry Lee Lewis's cooperation. Maybe at his insistence.
Exactly.
It would be a better word. Rick lived here for 4 years, and I currently live next door to the house that he owned when he lived here. So, yeah, I know Rick since way back when. And I made a point to drive him by the house. So we drive by, and I go, well, you know, here's where I live now. He nods, and he's quiet. He goes, damn it, Ted. He says, selling this house was the worst mistake I ever made.
And I think he means it, too.
He does mean it. He misses New Orleans. He misses it a lot. And he misses that house.
And New Orleans misses him, man, I tell you.
Yeah, I wouldn't be at all surprised if he ended up back in New Orleans at some point.
Oh, we'll keep our fingers crossed for that.
I know. And this is another road trip. I had to drive him to Pass Christiane to sign at Pass Christiane Books. And that was interesting as well, too, because I had not been out there to Pass Christiane since 2006, mm-hmm. when there was nothing out there.
Right. Well, it was a great lineup, Ted. So happy driving in the new year.
I hope I have a lot more gigs this next year, too.
And be careful out there because, you know, the future of American literature could be in your car.
That's true.
You know? We trust you. We've been talking with Ted O'Brien, literary escort and literary man about town. Thanks, Ted.
Thanks, Susan.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Gina Farrar curates the Poetry Buffet, Saturday, January 3rd, at 2 p.m. at Ladder Library. Sherry Cassanivet will moderate a six-week series based on Julia Cameron's Walking in This World, The Practical Art of Creativity, starting Monday, January 5th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library. Bill Lofelm reads from and signs Doing the Devil's Work, Tuesday, January 6th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Morgan Multhrop discusses in Sons Andrew Jackson's Playbook, 15 Strategies for Success from the Battle of New Orleans to the New NOLA, Tuesday, January 6th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library. And if you're looking for a New Year's resolution, consider helping a young child learn to read. Start the Adventure in Reading, the 29-year-old local children's literacy program, is seeking tutors for the 2015 school year. Tutor training begins Thursday, January 8th through Tuesday, January 20th. Only 1 2-hour training session is required and no experience is necessary. Tutors volunteer after school or on Saturday mornings over the course of the year at STAIR-operated sites in Orleans, Jefferson, Plaquemines, and St. Tammany parishes. Tutor training dates and sites are Thursday, January 8th at 1:30 at Algiers United Methodist Church, Saturday, January 10th at 9:30 at the Land Building at St. Charles Avenue Presbyterian, Tuesday, January 13th at 1:30 at St. Paul's United Methodist Church in Harahan, Wednesday, January 14th at 1:30 at St. Charles Avenue Presbyterian, Tuesday, January 20th at 1:30 at St. Augustine's Episcopal Church in Metairie. To register for training, contact the STAIR office at 899-0820 or email elizabeth at stairnola.org. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.